Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming in from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Don Scott, who's a Canadian, who has some amazing information on a number of the new diseases that are plaguing the American and Canadian people. Now, Sydney, you're not going to hear about these diseases. You're not going to hear about their origin. You're going to get what the media tells you. Just as today, the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, there's probably not more than 1 in 10,000 Americans who know that the King family brought a civil lawsuit against Lloyd Jowers for the part that he played in the murder of Martin Luther King, that a jury trial was held in the United States, that the jury held that the U.S. government was involved in the murder of Martin Luther King, that Lloyd Jowers had confessed the part that he was actually paid to assist in the murder of Martin Luther King, that the federal government sent an innocent man, James Earl Ray, to prison, where he eventually died. How could you suppress something of that sort in America? Why, we have freedom of the press. Those who own the press have the freedom to suppress whatever they want to. If you would like the story of Martin Luther King, we're putting together a four-tape set. You can order it now and certainly get it as soon as it's completed, probably in a few weeks, or you can wait and order it then. But you need to know about the trial that was held and how that information was suppressed, because, of course, they could not let the American people know of the complicity of high government officials and our intelligence agencies and the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, certainly of Bobby Kennedy, who incidentally was shot from behind, whereas Saran was standing in front, and then, of course, of Martin Luther King. It's all covered in a number of books we carry. One of them, The Elite Serial Killers. The Elite Serial Killers. But we'll have a wonderful four-tape set on the death of Martin Luther King very, very shortly. Well, with that as a background, let's get to our special guest this evening, Don Scott. Don, thank you so very much for being with us. It's late. I know it's getting late up there in Canada.
Yes, it's 11 o'clock at night, but it's always a pleasure to chat with you about these issues that you constantly placed before the public, and thank you for the opportunity again.
And thank you for the book. I got the new book that you've written. I've read the first part of it. I'm probably 40 or 50 pages into it. It's a 500-page book, but it's
actually 660 pages, Dr. Stan.
Tremendous amount of information, and of course, it's so difficult for the average American to believe that there could have been government complicity in the creation of this terrible, deadly disease. And yet, of course, although it took me a long time to become aware of that and really to be willing to accept that that is possible, that anybody could be that crass, that anybody could be that cruel, that anybody could be that indifferent to human suffering and death, I'm firmly convinced of the government complicity. And we don't know what part of the government, although there's a lot of evidence to suggest this work through the military, through the CIA, at the highest levels of our government, and everything has been done to conceal that information, because, of course, they could not let the American people understand that the government was involved in creating a disease that has killed countless millions of people throughout the world, and certainly well over 600,000 Americans, and, of course, it will continue and continue and continue, because there is no effective treatment or cure for this disease they've created, and that's exactly what they intended. But it wasn't just AIDS. It was chronic fatigue, it was fibromyalgia, it was certainly other disease. We'll be back in just a moment with Don Scott. Well, Don, you just go right ahead and pick the story up.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stan, and as you indicate, it's not just AIDS, but our book, AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief, focuses upon AIDS because it is a eugenics program. It is a program that was designed to reduce the population of the black people of the world. And this is done scientifically. This isn't something that happens because of lifestyle or nutrition or something along that line. And in our book, AIDS, the Crime Beyond Belief, we don't try to simply make a statement and then leave it for people to believe or not believe. We try to point out the scientific and medical evidence that was available to the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control, and especially when these so-called health-focused agencies of government were cooperating with the Department of Defense in the creation of biological weapons, and the biological weapons aimed at black people in particular when it respect to AIDS. Now, as an example of how we focused to the best of our ability on the science and medicine of AIDS as a eugenics agent, we have on page 538 of our book an item from 1953. Now, this is a summary of an article which appeared in a medical journal way back in 1953. And the medical journal was a very specialized journal that practically no ordinary citizen of the world would read, but it's one of the many journals that we studied in our study of the development of the AIDS cofactors. And the article is by Dr. Maurice Shepherd, a Ph.D., and it appeared in the American Journal of Syphilis, Gonorrhea, and Venereal Diseases, volume 38, pages 113 to 124. Now, this is a very obscure journal to the average person, and it is a very obscure subject to the average person.
Don, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don is certainly talking about the fact that the AIDS disease, and it is not caused, as you have been told, or most doctors believe, by simply a virus, by the HIV virus. It's much more complicated than that. But, of course, Don's statement, which will offend many people, is the fact that this disease is designed to target the blacks. Now, that's exactly what the Reverend Wright, who, of course, was the minister for Barack Obama, had said. Now, of course, just because he said it doesn't mean it isn't true. He is a black racist. I have no sympathy for him. But there are many black people who feel this disease was created to target the blacks. And if you want evidence of that for yourself, look at the AIDS statistics today. Almost half, or perhaps over half, of the AIDS cases in the United States are in the black population. That makes up only 13% of the nation's population. How could that have happened just by accident? They're much more promiscuous than anybody else. Do you honestly believe that? I mean, certainly if you go into Botswana today, and you... we actually do the figures there. The U.S. Census Bureau goes into Botswana and regularly tests the people there. 46% of the pregnant women in Botswana are HIV infected. They're all going to die. How could that have possibly happened? That is either the greatest public health tragedy of all time or the most successful genocidal policy. I would like to suggest it's the latter. So you pick up a story there. Don was telling us about how they had found or mentioned in a magazine published back in 1953, a rather obscure journal which most doctors, most people would never read. But what was the title of the article and who wrote it, Don?
The title was The Recovery of Pearl Pneumonia-like organisms from Negro men with and without non-gonococcal urethritis. And the importance of the article is that it points out that Dr. Shepherd took 100 healthy black Negro college students, and he took 100 healthy white college students, and he tested both of these groups, and they were both without urethritis, and yet the black students, healthy black students, had 56 out of the 100 black students carried naturally what they called a pleural pneumonia-like organism.
This was a mycoplasma organism.
This is a mycoplasma.
Right.
Naturally, these healthy black men carried this mycoplasma, whereas only 2 out of the white men carried the mycoplasma naturally. Now, here's the point. The evidence points out scientifically that AIDS is not a single disease agent. There is actually no such thing as an HIV virus or HI virus. There are cofactors, and one of the cofactors is a mycoplasma. Now, the mycoplasma is a particle of a bacterial DNA. Now, this is all very technical, but what it amounts to is this, that AIDS requires 2 disease agents, cofactors. One of the disease agents is the mycoplasma, and 56 out of 100 healthy black men carry this mycoplasma naturally without any signs of sickness or illness. It's part of their genetic makeup, whereas only 2 out of 100 white men carry it. Therefore, if the, as the evidence points out, AIDS is caused by cofactors, one of which is a mycoplasma, 56 out of 100 blacks already have that in their body genetically.
But I think isn't the mycoplasma that is associated with AIDS, isn't that a very specific one, the mycoplasma fermentans, not necessarily the mycoplasma pneumoniae, but certainly there is a retrovirus very closely related to the Wiesner sheep virus. That's what they call the HIV virus. But then what they never tell our physicians or the average American is there also is a mycoplasma infection along with that. But aren't most of that mycoplasma fermented incognitus?
Yes, the mycoplasma fermentans. The incognitus part seems to be very hard to establish, but the mycoplasma fermentans is the agent that these black students, subject of Dr. Shepherd's testing, were infected with. Now, the important point I'd like to make here is that the mycoplasma is not only a factor in AIDS, but it is a factor in other many, many, many other diseases, including cancer. Now, you can take the latest book that approaches the bestseller category in respect to cancers, and that is a book by Dr. Deborah Davis of Pittsburgh, and it's called The History of the Secret War on Cancer. And Dr. Davis points out in that Secret History of the War on Cancer that a significant, very, very significant number of blacks get cancers more than whites do. On almost every 20th or 30th page of her very scientific book, mixed in with exciting and important anecdotes, she has references to blacks being infected with certain cancers against the whites, who are 30% less infected than the blacks are. Now, why do blacks have more AIDS than whites, and why do blacks have more cancers than whites? Well, they found out in their scientific research, including the research of Dr. Shepherd, that blacks naturally carry the mycoplasma in their makeup. And there are other factors contribute to this mycoplasma emerging as AIDS in some people and as cancers in others. But there is a tendency, in fact, it's a reality that there is a distinct effort in the scientific world of medicine today to downplay the mycoplasma, to pretend it does not exist. And I can give a very, very good example of that. The Johns Hopkins Medical University, they produce an 1,800-page book called The Family Health Guide, and in it they claim to present in summary form all the important things you need to know about health in your family today. And in those 1,800 pages, nowhere do they mention the mycoplasma as being a disease agent that you should even know the name of, let alone know the role of.
And I think what's so interesting in your book, you pointed out that in the university, they have for military officers, military medical officers, there's a whole section on mycoplasma and, of course, how devastating this disease is. But the average doctor doesn't know that. I know when I went to medical school, I'd never heard of it. I never heard of mycoplasma until I came back from Africa about 1980 that they began to point out that almost a quarter of all the pneumonias we had, the atypical pneumonias, were related to mycoplasma. Almost a quarter of the influenzas we have today are related to mycoplasma, but the average doctor just doesn't know that because the people who control access to information don't want the doctors to know. So you go right ahead.
Yes, isn't it amazing that in the world of communication such as we have today, with all kinds of television shows and radio shows and special features and articles in newspapers and all the rest of it dealing with health, you won't find practically ever a reference to the mycoplasma and the fact that it plays a role not only in AIDS and chronic fatigue and lupus and so on, but even in Alzheimer's. And in our book, on page 627, we summarize for our readers the mycoplasma pneumoniae clinical manifestations of infection. Now, this is a way that this particular mycoplasma species, and there are many, 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 many more species, but this is just one of them. The mycoplasma pneumoniae can turn up in the respiratory system, according to this chart on page 627 of our book. And there's a whole list of diseases that people get from that in the respiratory system. It can turn up in their neurological system. It can turn up in their cardiac system. It can turn up in their gastrointestinal system. It can turn up in the hematological system and the muscular, skeletal, genital, urinary, and immunological system. Now, that's all on one chart in one page of our book, to demonstrate that the mycoplasma is a very serious disease agent. But if you turn to the Johns Hopkins Family Health Book, 1,800 pages, you won't find it mentioned anywhere. Well, when we tried to find it and it wasn't in the Johns Hopkins Family Health Book, we phoned the editor of that health book. That's Dr. Michael J. Quagg. And he wasn't available to talk to us at the time we phoned him in August 2005, and he wasn't available a few weeks later, and he wasn't available a couple of months later than that. And then finally we got hold of his assistant, and she said, "What is it you want to talk to Dr. Craig about?" And I said, "Well, I already have left a message several times."
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. All right, go ahead. You finally got hold of the doctor's assistant there at Johns Hopkins University, trying to find out why they would put out this the very extensive book and never mention the mycoplasm. So what did the assistant tell you?
Well, the assistant said, it is because there's no reference to the mycoplasma, and that's what you're calling about. And I said, yes, we want to know why in the 1,800 pages that many, many, many families buy this great book because it touts itself as being America's number one health book for the family and all the rest of it. There's no mention of the mycoplasma and its role in all of these diseases. Well, this assistant, Dr. Clegg, said, well, we'll get some information on that and get back to you, and she never did. So I phoned her again and phoned her again and phoned Dr. Clegg again, and as recently as 2 weeks ago, I phoned Dr. Clegg and left a message saying, tell me why in the John Hopkins Family Health Book, nowhere in those 1,800 pages do you mention the mycoplasma, and yet it is involved in all of these critical human diseases, including cancers. And no answer from Dr. Clegg. And the reason, what possible reason could there be for not putting into a family health book an important disease agent such as the mycoplasma and telling how it is involved as a cofactor in AIDS? That is because the U.S. government, through the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control, wish to keep from the American people and from the world the reality that so many of these tragic diseases, including AIDS, which takes 8,000 lives daily, and cancer, and lupus, and cardiovascular diseases, and Alzheimer's, they don't want the public to know where that disease is coming from. And they don't want them to know because the U.S. government was very, very instrumental over the years in developing this mycoplasmal species as a biological agent to reduce the world's population, especially a biological agent which would target black people because black people naturally carry the mycoplasma because of their genetic makeup, whereas the whites don't carry it.
And I think it's really so important, Don, for the average individual to really understand that there is a population control agenda. And there really are people out there who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world because they feel that people like you and I are consuming their natural resources. And they really feel that we need to eliminate perhaps half, two-thirds, nine-tenths of the world's population, depends upon who you talk to, but they have no compassion, they're not concerned about the human suffering associated with this, and they're actively engaged in an effort to conceal many treatments which should be readily available to the medical profession and are not. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yes, by denying it to the medical profession, they deny it to the public, and by denying the information to the public, they make the public more vulnerable to these diseases that they pretend to fight against. Mm-hmm. And they carry on, the public carries on.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don Scott was simply pointing out that he had repeatedly tried to call the editor of this 1,800-page book put out by Johns Hopkins and asking him why they didn't mention mycoplasma infections. I mean, a quarter of all atypical pneumonia is related to that. A quarter of influenza is related to it. How could you write a book for the general public about disease and ignore the part that mycoplasma played? And of course, after calling numerous times, it's very obvious they are not going to reply, and they certainly do not want the American people to realize or the doctors to realize. The doctors certainly are victims of this as well. And everything is done to play down the part that the mycoplasma plays in so many of the diseases that afflict their patients. But that information is censored. Why? Because, as Don points out, one of the major thrusts of American foreign and domestic policy is population control? Wouldn't we be far better off without so many elderly people? Then the Medicare system would work. If we didn't have so many people, the Social Security system would work. The problem is that people are living so long, and if they were to die off much earlier, all of these grandiose utopian plans would work better. And people say nobody could be that crass and indifferent, and I would say, I used to think that way. I no longer do. Please go ahead, Don.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. And in Dr. Davis's book, nowhere in the whole book does she mention once the word mycoplasma. But not only that, Dr. Davis, in that book called The Secret History of the War on Cancer, she's playing on words that people use in society without really knowing the reality. The people don't know the reality of what's going on. She plays on it and yet does not herself tell the whole story. And yet we have reason to believe that she knows the whole story, because in our research we found, as you have found many years ago, that an important role was played by the United States government in developing the cofactors that lead to AIDS, one of them being the mycoplasma. You discovered that the Special Virus Cancer Program, which was supposed to be part of Richard Nixon's War on Cancer, where Nixon, through his spokesperson Henry Kissinger, said they were going to find the cause and cure for cancer, and they got the Congress to go along, Congress and Senate to go along, just like they got the Congress and Senate to go along with the Iraq War, with a whole lot of hocus-pocus baloney. And they created, or they said they were creating, a special virus cancer program. And in her book, Dr. Davis doesn't mention the special virus cancer program at all by name. She mentions the fact that some of her colleagues were involved in the Great War on Cancer, but she does not really, nowhere in the book does she mention the special virus cancer program. And unlike our book, where we show how the special virus cancer program did not begin in 1972 when Nixon declared war on cancer, it began way back in 1952 when President Eisenhower was elected president, and he said to Nelson Rockefeller, I want you in my cabinet, what role would you like? And Nelson Rockefeller surprised everybody who seemed to know anything about politics in those days. He said that he wanted to be Assistant Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. And what does he know about health, education, and welfare? Well, the thing is, Nelson Rockefeller was bringing into the official government agenda of the United States part of what is called the Rockefeller apparatus agenda. And a significant part of that agenda was genetics, the eugenic reduction of population growth. And this was a great campaign of the Rockefellers and their colleagues, the Morgans and the Harrimans and others, for many years. But in 1952, Nelson Rockefeller was able to get an appointment as Assistant Secretary of especially Health. And what did he do? Well, according to the book called The Rockefellers by Collier and Horowitz, and this isn't Dr. Leonard Horowitz, by the way, this is another Horowitz, but in that very, very important biography of the Rockefellers, the Horowitz and Collier point out that Nelson Rockefeller, when he went into the National Institutes for Health as Assistant Secretary...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment there.
Anybody?
Okay, this is Dr. Stan. I guess Don Scott and you was just talking about, of course, the book, The Rockefellers by Collier and Horowitz. And after Nelson Rockefeller became the Assistant Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, that would have been 1953, what did he do?
He created what he called a war room. And he did not share what he was doing with his fellow colleagues in health, education, and welfare. He brought in many, many, many people from the Rockefeller apparatus, and in secret they began cooperating with the Department of Defense. Now, he's supposed to be concerned with health, but he began working with the Department of Defense. And the evidence that emerges is they established programs where their intent was to develop the mycoplasma as a disease agent because it had been learned by the scientists of that time that the mycoplasma was an excellent agent to have involved in biological warfare because it put down the human immune system.
In other words, mycoplasma suppresses the immune system, and it is by suppressing the immune system, of course, the people get cancer and so many other diseases. If they can't fight off the diseases, they succumb to them. So go right ahead.
Yes, so here is Nelson Rockefeller with the Rockefeller agenda working in the government of the United States, and they established under the CIA, which was also newly created just before Eisenhower was elected, was created by President Truman. Under Eisenhower and Rockefeller and Allen Dulles, it was greatly extended. They created a special program called MK Ultra. Now, the MK, we know, stands for monkey kidneys. And ULTRA, we know from official government documents, stands for umbrella. So a monkey kidney program with umbrella quality, it means a whole lot of things could go on under it. They established the MK ULTRA as the umbrella organization. And under MK ULTRA, they established the MK DELTA program and the MK Naomi program. And these were CIA programs where they were attempting to take the mycoplasma. Now, we have all the evidence.
Hold that thought, Tom. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don was simply pointing out that, of course, when Nelson Rockefeller became the Assistant Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, he brought in many people from the Rockefeller organizations, foundations, and others. Their goal, population control. They established a relationship with the Department of the Army. They began to develop the mycoplasma. Why? Because mycoplasma is an excellent biological warfare agent because it suppresses the immune system and, of course, predisposes people to disease and to cancer. Why would anybody do that? Because there are people who are dedicated to population control. And that became the major theme of the Nixon administration when in 1974 they put forward the National Security Study Memorandum 200 pointing out that the major thrust of American foreign domestic policy was population control. But back in 1953, when Nelson Rockefeller was working there as a high official in the Department of Health, why, of course, they were beginning then to determine how they could use the mycoplasma as a biological warfare agent, not against the enemy, but against the American people and against people in all civilized societies, because there were just too many of them. What an effective means of destroying humanity, other than to develop a new pathogen that would destroy the immune system. So you pick up the story there, Don.
Yes, well, Rockefeller in Hugh established the war room. They established the monkey kidney ultra program, and the idea there was to take monkey kidneys and grind them up into a pulp and use them as a source of food for the mycoplasma, and to breed the mycoplasma in vast, vast quantities so that they could have it to work with in their laboratories under their program, MKUltra, and so on. Now, they wanted to develop the mycoplasma because it, as I mentioned, is an absolutely efficient agent for the depression of the human immune system. So you can you can put down the immune system. It's like putting down the fence around the lion's cage in the zoo. With that fence down, the lions can get out. With the immune system down, the disease agents, such as the agents that cause cancer, and there are viral origins for cancer that we have learned about and that we are writing about and so on, can get in. And not only can the cancer virus, which sounds very sensational, but we've got the evidence, we can't go into it here, but all the other opportunistic diseases that can enter into a human body when the immune system is down, and then when you have that situation, you have AIDS. So they established a camp called Camp Lindy in the Belgian Congo, and they captured many hundreds of chimpanzees, and they brought these chimpanzees to Camp Lindy, and they raised them there, and they killed them, and they took their kidneys and they grew the mycoplasma on it, and then they used the mycoplasma in various experiments under the guise of testing an anti-polio disease control agent. And this was under Dr. Hilary Koprowski of the Wistar Institute in the United States. But in addition to that, they established in New Orleans, under the auspices of Dr. Alton Ochsner of Tulane University, they established a program there, and they created a delta primate farm to raise rhesus monkeys. This meant a separate program under MKUltra called MKDelta, and the MK stands for the monkey kidney. The delta stands for the Mississippi Delta. And so, actually, they were working on two species of AIDS, one based upon the kidneys of chimpanzees in Belgium, Congo, and one based upon the kidneys of rhesus monkeys in Tulane University and Delta Primate Farm in Louisiana. And so we have two types of AIDS. One type of AIDS was used in vaccines against black people in Africa, where the colonies were administered by Belgians, British, and French. The other vaccine was used in Brazil, Goa, and other colonies administered by the Portuguese, and was developed by Dr. Alton Ochsner of Tulane University. So the United States government, under the aegis of Nelson Rockefeller, took a disease agent, made it into a biological agent, and spread it to the target populations that they especially had in mind, and AIDS was on its way under various kinds of CIA code names. But when it was just nicely getting going, and Eisenhower's term expired, 8 years was up, they fully expected that his vice president, Richard Nixon, would succeed him and he would carry on with the program. But he was defeated by John F. Kennedy, who was very much anti-population control. He wanted the world's population to be modified, but he wanted it to be modified by individual efforts to limit family size without the government coming in with secret programs. So essentially, the programs that had been developed under Eisenhower and Nelson Rockefeller and the CIA went into a period of hiatus. where nothing was done for 3 years worth mentioning because they couldn't do it without Kennedy finding out about it. And it was not until he was murdered by the same agents that were developing the AIDS as a device to limit world population growth. It was only after he was killed, and he was succeeded by a person, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who I must say to the people of the United States was a gangster. William Baines Johnson brought the program back out in full swing when he succeeded Mr. Kennedy as President of the United States. And you can find this in Johnson's own biography, a book he called Vantage Point. And in that book, Vantage Point, he says that when he came into the presidency, succeeding Mr. Kennedy, he found that only $6 million a year was being used on population control programs, and that by the time he left, he said, that was up to $115 million a year. Look at the number of times it was doubled to go from $6 million to $115 million. And Johnson established a population control council with the John Rockefeller III and William Cohen as co-chairman, and they were back in business to create the biological agents for the limitation of population growth. Then, of course, Mr. Johnson was succeeded by Nixon, and Nixon appointed Henry Kissinger as his national security advisor, and Henry Kissinger was then able to take the whole, all these programs that had first existed as CIA programs and then had been moved out of the CIA basement by Johnson. He was able to put them front and center with a special virus cancer program, and they got into the full-time business then, not so much of finding out how to create AIDS, but how to get it spread, because they had already found this out when the work of Dr. Huebner and others told them how dangerous the mycoplasma was. And this is where Johns Hopkins comes in. Johns Hopkins and many, many other apparently reputable, believable institutions of great public trust were actually betraying the public trust. Now, we have a good example of that in Canada as well. We have a university here in Canada called Queen's University in Kingston. During this period of time, at Queen's University, they were receiving every month from what we call the Dominion Parasite Laboratory in Belleville, Ontario, Canada, 100 million mosquitoes a month. Now, the government of Canada was breeding 100 million mosquitoes a month. Now, can you or your listeners picture a government breeding mosquitoes and doing this secretly and transferring this, the mosquitoes every month to the Queen's University, and Queen's University then contaminates them with various disease agents, and they won't say what the disease agents were, but we are very, very convinced that it was, among them was the mycoplasma. Queen's University contaminates these mosquitoes, then they give them to the Canadian military, and the Canadian military shares them with the United States military. So you now have, in the hands of the U.S. military, the Canadian military, the British military, agents of population control, which present, as among other things, as AIDS and as chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, I made this statement showing all of our sources down at a meeting near Kingston, Ontario, a few years ago. And I showed all the documents. We've got the documents. My goodness, there's no lack of documents. There's just a lack of publication of those in the mainline media. And I sure demonstrated the Queen's University's complicity in creating these disease agents. And the newspaper reporter for the Brockville Times, he was at the meeting, and he was kind of one of these smart-alecky guys that Don Scott is a conspiracy theorist. He ignored all the scientific documents I had, including Dr. Shepard's 1953 paper and so on. And he got in touch with Queen's University. And the dean of the medicine at Queen's University said, well, that's not true at all. And it was true, believe me. And he says, if Don Scott says this again, Queen's University will sue him. Wonderful news. Wonderful news. I was looking so much forward to being sued in a court of law by Queen's University to present my evidence about how Queen's University had cooperated with the Dominion Parasite Laboratory and with the United States military in creating mycoplasma-infected mosquitoes. And although they said they would sue me if I said it again, I sent them a notice telling them I was going to say it again at a meeting, and they were invited to be there with cameras and recording devices and get it all on tape for their suit. They never turned up. And I'll try to keep them pretty well notified whenever I get a chance that I'm saying it again and again and again. That AIDS and other diseases that have a mycoplasmal component but largely responsible, is largely the responsibility of the United States government. And as you mentioned in the interlude of this program, Pastor Wright was absolutely correct when he said that AIDS was developed by the CIA to decimate the black population.
It is decimating the black population in the United States, as I mentioned earlier.
Yes,
almost
United
half
States.
Of the cases in the United States are in blacks. And you go into Africa, it's decimating the population there because it's made to targeted for blacks. When you understand that, you can understand why many blacks are resentful. And why aren't the whites out there trying to find out if it's really true and then demanding that the people who are guilty of these terrible crimes against humanity be held responsible? It's really men and women become accomplices of the evils they fail to oppose. And if you're listening to this program, I hope you'll want to check out what's being said. We'll give you the sources where you can begin to evaluate this on your own. And could it really be true? And I believe with all my heart that it is. Go right ahead, Don. Go right ahead, Don.
Dr. Stan, our book, which we sent you a copy of and you have been looking at, and reading, AIDS, A Crime Beyond Belief, we tried to bring together the medical evidence, the scientific evidence, the historical evidence, the political evidence, and military evidence, and so on, all in one book, which demonstrates that AIDS and chronic fatigue, new diseases brought into the world through the agency of the mycoplasma and the cofactors, plus the burgeoning numbers of cancer cases in Canada, United States, and the world, and the role of the mycoplasma in those diseases as well, and how books such as that by Dr. Deborah Davis, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, mislead the public about many, many aspects of the programs, and we count on people like yourself and your program to share with the listeners who are alert to what they're really hearing. AIDS and the related diseases are the product of American government scientific manipulation for purposes of limiting population growth rate.
And of course, most of the people who work for the government have no ideas about this. Most of this is related to the Defense Department or, of course, to the CIA, that special contingent of the CIA that is involved in truly evil and dark activities. So our guest, of course, is Don Scott. You'll go right ahead, Don.
Dr. Stan, I'm sorry, you faded out almost totally there, and I didn't hear that last statement.
Well, I just said that certainly there are lots of people working in the government who have no idea what this is about, but there is an element within our military, there is an element within the CIA, who are sworn to secrecy. If they were to reveal what they know, they'd be sent to prison for the rest of their lives or killed. They cannot allow the American people to really realize what's going on. I mean, after all, could you imagine if it came out that that AIDS was actually created in a laboratory, that they spent millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to develop this terrible new disease, and the chronic fatigue disease that affects probably well over a million Americans, and the fibromyalgia that afflicts 2 million Americans, and the Lyme disease that incapacitates another million Americans, that these were actually created in laboratories to disable and destroy human lives? Well, Don, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stan. I appreciate the opportunity of sharing with you and with your listeners the realities of the mycoplasma as a disease agent that is vital to the health of humanity. And as long as it remains in the shadows, as long as reputable, supposedly reputable authorities like Dr. Deborah Davis don't even mention the mycoplasma, and as long as the Johns Hopkins University Medical School, in their horrendously thick book, don't even mention the mycoplasma, there must be something missing. And from the story that's available to the public, and the truth that is available to the public, is the fact that the mycoplasmal species are dangerous disease agents. They're almost totally ignored in the world. And we hope that our book, and I hope that you will be able to carry the book with your book service.
Yes, we will carry the book.
Our book, AIDS, A Crime Beyond Belief, sets out as much of the evidence as we could put into a single volume of 660 pages. And I thank you very much for this opportunity of sharing the information. And I do want to say to the listeners throughout the United States and the world that, as has been mentioned earlier, Pastor Wright was correct. There is a reluctance on the part of many, many people, including most Americans, to face the realities of where these diseases came from. And as long as that reluctance remains, then cancer will continue to spread, especially among the blacks. Alzheimer's will continue to increase in numbers. Parkinson's will continue to increase in numbers. And all the diseases that are related to mycoplasma will continue to extend their dire effects to humanity.
Well, I'm going to have to get you back on, Don, so we can talk about this in much more detail. The book, of course, is AIDS, the Crime Against Humanity. We'll be carrying the book as soon as we have an opportunity. Are you going to order it? I don't know what it'll cost, but we'll have to get you the figures on that. But we're going to do a number of programs with Don as we explore this entire subject. Now, Reverend White, associated with Barack Obama, is black racist, and I have no sympathy for him at all. But just because he says something doesn't mean it isn't true. And when you realize this disease is designed to kill blacks, it's a horrible thing to contemplate. Good night. God bless.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly I hope you enjoyed our interview with Don Scott. We're going to have a number of the interviews with him. And as we were just saying, Pastor Wright, who is Barack Obama's minister, has said that AIDS was created to kill blacks. And, of course, if you study this issue, you'll know that it's absolutely true, and we'll give you the documentation on that in subsequent interviews. I have no sympathy at all for Reverend White. He's a black racist, and there's no room for racism among honorable people today. He's doing everything he can, of course, to destroy our country. He has no love for America, and he is a very dangerous man. But just because some of the things he said were absolutely right, that doesn't mean that or just because some of the things he said, you have to recognize they may well be right, but of course they're trying to destroy them and these ideas, because you're supposed to hate Reverend Wright. Do not hate him. Pity anybody who has so much hatred in him. Now, if you're interested in getting Don Scott's book, you can give us a call. We'll let you know when we know what it will come to. But you really would want to get my material, my talk on Nundare, call it genocide. It goes into population control. My talk on planned population reduction. My talk on population control, which is available on video, will soon be available on DVD. We've written a treatise. You can find it on our website of RadioLiberty.com. It's called The Population Control Agenda Monograph. The Population Control Agenda Monograph. Go to RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com. You can pull it down, or if you would prefer and you get into the other items, you could simply ask for a copy of the Population Control Agenda Monograph, and we'll send it to you free of charge. If you get some of the other items, we have a 4-tape set or a 4-CD set on population control. You must understand that the reason that DDT was outlawed was not because it was harmful to humanity or was killing all the fishes. It was such an effective means of saving human lives. And since, of course, we've discontinued the use of DDT, why, we've killed almost 100 million people. Since we discontinued using DDT, we've killed almost 100 million African people. And if you hate Africans, why, of course, you'd support that decision to outlaw DDT. It's interesting that now the World Health Organization has said, gee, maybe it really isn't as dangerous as we thought it was, and now we're going to start using it to spray rooms, why we can save millions of lives every year. Now, of course, there's another lie they tell you, that malaria only kills 1 million people a year. It kills about 3 million people a year, predominantly black. You can verify this on the Internet. Just go up on Google and Google in a malaria kills, 3 million people a year. You'll find out that what they're telling you in the controlled media in the United States just isn't true. And once you begin to understand that, of course, so many things begin to make sense. The media is controlled in the United States. The book, of course, is The New Media Monopoly by Ben Bogdakian, Professor Bogdakian, who points out that 5 mega corporations control the media, and they express freedom of the press. They own the press. They have the freedom to suppress whatever they want to. And the last thing they want you to know is that the HIV virus was genetically modified, that mycoplasma plays a part in this. There are 2 books we carry. One is called Emerging Viruses. Emerging Viruses, excellent book on this subject. It's what actually convinced me. The other is called Project Daily, written by Garth Nicholson. And, of course, he was one of the most outstanding scientists in America, is even to this very day, with over 600 peer-reviewed articles. And if you read his book, you'll find out, of course, that the part that mycoplasma plays in the AIDS epidemic. He is the person who told me he had met one person who was involved in the process of actually developing this new disease. There's a book called Full Disclosure, or Final Disclosure, Full Disclosure, I think it is, which, of course, we quote in our material, where, of course, one of the people who was involved in developing the disease, AIDS, was dying of cancer and came forward and told the truth. You will never hear this mentioned by the controlled media. The last thing they want you to know is that this is a created disease. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grieg. You can get his writings at www.rightsourceonline.com. That's www.rightsourceonline.com. You get to his blog spot that way, but certainly William is one of the most interesting and accurate journalists that we have, one of our favorite commentators. In fact, I was simply in Southern California this last couple of days, and it was amazing how many people came up to me and told me how much they enjoy William Grieg commentaries on Radio Liberty. So without further ado, William, thank you so very much for being with us.
Are edified by what we have to say.
Amen to that. Can you speak up just a little louder, please?
Sure can. Yeah.
How's that? Okay, well, go right ahead.
I'm going to be a little diffident this evening because I just had a root canal this morning, so I'm a little tender here. But
all right, fine. Well, you go right ahead. Well, I appreciate you being with us because I know you're probably not feeling the greatest.
But, you know, such as it is, that's the way life works out. I am really struck by a couple of things that I saw in the news today that, once again, attest to a subject and a reality that we've addressed on many occasions, and that is the unfolding, full-orbed global economic catastrophe that we're confronting right now. The thing that I find really interesting here, we've talked about the Zimbabwe circumstances before, the situation where they've got hyperinflation of an almost unprecedented magnitude going on in that country that was delivered into the tender care of a Marxist, a deranged Marxist despot by the name of Robert Mugabe about 30 years ago by our State Department. But they just issued a $50 million note. The Zimbabwean dollar, of course, is worth less with each passing second, and a $50 million Zimbabwean note is enough to buy, I think, 3 loaves of bread in that country. And we've got a situation unfolding right now where, in spite of the fact that it appears that the opposition in Zimbabwe, notwithstanding all the efforts by Mugabe's regime to make it impossible for the opposition to win, apparently they did win an election. It was held just about a week ago. And yet, of course, Robert Mugabe, who's in his dotage, he's in his early 80s now, he's somebody who probably suffers from several different forms of dementia, including one of a syphilitic nature. He's going to hold on for as long as he can. It's just an amazing thing when you take a look at the brazenness with which he's continuing to rule amid the consummate wreckage of what had been one of the wealthiest and most productive economies in Africa.
Well, I think the most important thing with him is the fact that he was put in power over the objection of the Rhodesian people,
yeah,
by the American State Department and by Henry Kissinger, with a promise that if things ever got out of hand, America would come to their aid. And the Rhodesian people, the only criticism I would have is that they trusted what the American State Department said.
Yeah.
And they didn't understand the American State Department is under the control of a very evil group called the Council on Foreign Relations that has a different worldview, and Henry Kissinger is an agent of the Rockefellers, and they were intent upon destroying that nation, that fine, upstanding Christian nation where there was no racial discrimination, where there was no apartheid. And they insisted on Robert Mugabe being given that, and we can see the end result of the American State Department policy. I only hope and pray that is not what they intend for our country, because there's no instance in all history where a nation has gone under a fiat money system and has survived, and we are on a fiat money system, and our leaders are intent upon destroying our economy. I'm firmly convinced of that. They've created this whole housing mess, but they've created all the other bubbles that threaten us today. The hedge fund bubble, the derivative bubble. And, of course, if these things, as they unfold here and throughout the world, why, well, maybe we'll end up with a global currency. Who knows?
Well, as you point out, the situation in Zimbabwe could be a foreshadowing of our future here in the United States if the time ever comes that a decision is made simply to monetize the debt that our government owes. And by doing so, of course, you'd be repudiating it. And somebody once said, I can't remember, it was probably Lord Keynes who said it, that inflation is simply the slow-motion repudiation of debt, which is one reason, of course, why the Treasury notes that our government circulates in order to raise money to fund its expenditures, its debt expenditures, those Treasury notes are not being bought up with quite the alacrity that they had been before in the international currency markets, which explains, among other reasons, why the dollar is falling in value and why prices are rising. But the thing about Zimbabwe that I find most remarkable here, once again, is the fact that for all of the derangement of that system and all of the atrocities committed by that regime, both physical and fiscal, they're nowhere near as badly off in terms of the debt picture of that government as our government is. And the only reason, this is something we've talked about before, the only reason why we've been spared the ravages of hyperinflation is the fact that the dollar is the world's reserve currency. So you have this anomalous situation, this historical oddity, in which the world's leading debtor nation is the nation whose government also emits the world's reserve currency. And we've been basically bankrupt as a nation since August of 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window and sundered the last remaining connections between the dollar and gold. And this was being done because the government, under LBJ particularly, during the guns and butter binge of the Vietnam era and Great Society era, had basically bankrupted the country. Foreign creditors were starting to demand that the United States redeem dollars in gold, and rather than do so, rather than admit that this is no longer possible, Nixon simply sundered the connection between the dollar and gold. And since August 15th, 1971, we've been living basically in a state of quasi-receivership, it seems to me. And you mentioned Kissinger in the earlier segment, Dr. Stan, and of course Kissinger's chief accomplishment in the mid-1970s that created a system that kept the dollar afloat was to set up this relationship with the Saudi Arabians, in which the Saudis would get pretty much everything they wanted in exchange for taking the dollar, and only the dollar, as the medium of exchange for their petroleum. And being the dominant element of the OPEC oil cartel, that decision defined the policy of OPEC, and for that reason, the dollar has been backed essentially by petroleum, because it's taken in exchange for petroleum, and that makes it at least somewhat legitimate in the eyes of the world. And now these Gulf states, with the possible exception of the Saudis, and the Saudis are not nice people at all, of course. The Saudis generate a lot of the radical Islamic extremism.
Hold that thought, Richard. Hold that thought for just a moment here as we bring other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sidney William was simply saying that one reason why, of course, we do not have rampant inflation in the United States is because we've been essentially exporting our inflation to other countries because we're the reserve currency of the world. And the other reason, of course, is because we have a cozy relationship with the brutal and tyrannical Saudi regime, and we keep this brutal, inhumane, feudalistic system in power as long as they agree to accept only dollars in payment for their oil, which allows us then, of course, to dominate the world financial system. But all of this, I fear, is coming to an end very, very soon, and it may well be that before long, why, the Saudis are going to cut the relationship between oil and the American dollar. And when that happens, ladies and gentlemen, hang on to your hats, hang on to your purses, although there may not really be any need to hang on to your purses, because what you have in them may very soon become worthless. Go ahead, pick the story up.
That would take us in the direction of a Zimbabwean-style hyperinflation, because those dollars have come flooding back to the United States. And when you're talking about trillions of dollars in circulation right now, well in excess of the gross domestic product of the United States, many multiples of that, you're talking about something that would undermine the subjective value of the dollar to the point where it would be as worthless as the Reichmark was in 1923, or as worthless as the Zimbabwean dollar is today. One thing that we should point out with respect to the relationship with the Saudi Arabian regime here, this petrodollar accord that was hashed out by this despicable figure called Henry Kissinger, is the fact that the Saudi Arabian connection explains a lot in terms of what's going on right now with the possible and I think likely attack on Iran. To the extent that they have the ability to do so, the people running the Bush administration would love to start up some kind of an open conflict with Iran. And that dovetails nicely with the interests of Saudi Arabia in the region. If you take a look at the way that things have been lined up, even on the ground in Iraq, the the radical Sunnis on the ground in Iraq, who were pretty much in charge of the worst elements of the insurgency, were cultivated as security assets during the last part of last year. And this was done at a time when it was being made clear through diplomatic accords with their diplomatic contacts with Riyadh and Saudi Arabia that the Saudis were interested in creating some kind of a movement, sort of a pan-Sunni movement, to contain Shiite Iran as the other major player in the region. And so you've got a situation here where once again we're being jerked around by foreign interests and contravention of the wise advice we had from George Washington about staying aloof from entangling alliances. And we've got a bunch of entangling alliances in the region, and they're the tail wagging the dog right now in a very real sense. But this isn't surprising to the architects of our foreign policy. I mean, they want us to remain entangled in the region. They want us to make sure that there is no plausible prospect of some kind of a constructive and just peace, because that's not in accord with their long-term designs. War is a crucible where they're forging the fetters of our new global system, and they want us to remain entangled in the Gulf. They want us to remain deeply mired in Mesopotamia and in the Gulf region, and they want to keep peace from breaking out between the Israelis and their neighbors, and to that end, they do everything they can to sow discord and conflict and to generate the frictions that are very useful for their long-term design. I remember a conversation I had back in 1994 when I was in Egypt covering a UN conference, the New American magazine. I was talking to a Dutch diplomat, and he was somebody who was somewhat critical of Washington and American foreign policy, but generally friendly to the Americans he ran into. And I remember talking to him about how disgusted I was at our foreign policy, in the sense that we seemed to place a premium on making sure the people didn't get along, and we seemed to be perversely determined to be underwriting both sides of every conflict, including the Middle East. And this fellow said, well, I think it actually might be a good idea to have the United States in the role of paying both sides, because that way at least you can contain them. You can keep them from killing each other outright. I said, well, you're missing the whole point here. I mean, by virtue of inserting ourselves in that quarrel, you're providing an incentive for the worst elements of both sides to make sure that there is no lasting peaceful relationship between the parties, because if that happens, we have no excuse to remain there. Well, you know, once we're involved, the radicals on the ground want to keep us involved, and of course the power elite back in Washington and in London and elsewhere wants to keep us involved as well. So it works to their mutual benefit, and in the meantime, of course, innocent people on both sides get killed, and our country gets driven even more deeply into debt, and we find ourselves even more passionately loathed by hundreds of millions of people who otherwise might look upon us with great esteem. Robert Welch once said something very provocative. He said a lot of provocative things in the course of a long and very fruitful public career, but way back in 1979, he gave a speech in Colorado where he lamented the fact that the United States, which had once been the most universally admired country for practicing the commendable virtue of minding our own business, was becoming the most universally reviled country for, and I'm paraphrasing Welch carefully here, for its universal practice of imperialism by the dollar as the substitute for the sword. Now that phrase, imperialism by the dollar, really embedded itself in my memory, and I think it's a very useful description here. Robert Welch, of course, was a patriot. He was somebody who believed in national sovereignty and wanted to see our country prosperous and free, and he believed, as I do, that our country is the greatest that God has ever graced humanity, with which God has ever graced humanity. But that having been said, of course, our government is another matter, and the fact that we have seen our government under the influence of the Council on Foreign Relations of like-minded people of that type has been so eagerly cultivating conflict, and through the so-called dollar diplomacy has been impoverishing other countries through the export of inflation. That's something which has done nobody any good, and we've lived in something of a fool's paradise for the last several decades. This illusion of prosperity, which we've enjoyed on the basis of, you know, borrowed money and artificially managed markets in this country, that's something that has to end sometime. And as you pointed out, there's every indication right now that it's coming to an end. Now, as you take a look at the sclerosis which is afflicting the credit markets, banks no longer being willing to lend to each other, because of the unimaginable volume of bad debts in the system, and the Federal Reserve now essentially nationalizing the investment markets, nationalizing Wall Street. This is a very efficient way, of course, to ensure that the politically connected super rich don't pay the financial penalty of their own corruption. You know, they're basically in a position where they're taxing us, depreciating the money that we earn in order to subsidize the big boys on Wall Street. These are all auguries of some very bad times to come, and they're unfolding right now, albeit nowhere near as quickly as some people would have expected them to. But then again, when you see what's happened with the unemployment figures coming out today, see that there was, I believe, 0.3% jump just in the last couple of months. You take a look at what's going on with the completely depressed housing and construction market, and once again, the escalating foreclosure rates. This is the month, this month and next month, when a lot of adjustable rate mortgages are going to reset, and a lot of people are going to find themselves underwater, upside down in terms of their equity, and underwater in terms of their household finances. It's not going to get any better from here, I'm afraid.
And I think we have to realize that hundreds of thousands of people have had their homes foreclosed on. The federal government keeps talking about doing something, but if you look at what they're talking about, why, of course, none of it is really going to do much of any good at all. They're talking about putting out, $100 million for counseling of the people who are going to lose their homes. That's about $4,000 for every home that's foreclosed on, 250,000 homes. Counseling those people, they're going to get $4,000 worth of counseling, and they're still going to be homeless.
Sure.
And, of course, if you see what the federal government is advocating, none of it's going to do any good. See what the states are advocating. It's all window dressing. And certainly if it were an effective program, why, the governors are threatening to veto it. So understand that they're going to give you the impression they're trying to stop the cascading deluge of home foreclosures, but they're really doing effectively nothing. And we're talking about literally millions of Americans are being forced out of their homes, and those homes going on the market simply driving down the price of homes. And of course, we're going to see people, even affluent people who have these good AAA loans, finding that they're actually paying a mortgage on a house that's worth far less on the real market than their mortgage. And are they going to do that, or are they simply going to walk away? Going to be very interesting to see what happens. Go ahead, William.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of people simply mail in their keys to their mortgage lenders now. This is something which is happening here in Idaho. I know that I mentioned before how in Eagle, Idaho, which is a fairly upscale suburb of Boise, that is rife with really well-appointed, I think they'd call them McMansion-style homes, with granite countertops and other amenities of that sort. They have huge tracts of foreclosed homes that were built. Some of them haven't even been finished yet because the financing fell through before they could finish the homes. But they're having bus tours here of foreclosed properties in Eagle, Idaho. And I've noticed that there are a couple of other places in the country where they're having bus tours where real estate brokers will pool together and then hire a bus to take a scenic tour of all these foreclosed homes in the hope, the often forlorn hope, of attracting buyers. But, of course, the problem is that when you're dealing with a general trend line of sinking home values, you don't want to find yourself being turned upside down, as you described, where people simply owe too much on a mortgage, and they owe more on the mortgage than the market value of their home. It's a horrible situation. It's one that's becoming quite common.
Well, I think the great, great tragedy is there's no question in my mind that this is all created. They knew exactly what they were doing. Alan Greenspan was warned about this. If you've seen that interview with 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl, why, of course, he lied to Leslie, and when Leslie caught him on the lie, he just changed the subject. This is happening intentionally, maliciously, but the question is, where is it going to end up? I think it's going to end up with the demise of our monetary system, because you can't have a world government unless you have a global currency. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could destroy the American currency and establish a world government? Go right ahead.
One of the things that we need to talk about with respect to the foreclosures, which are becoming increasingly common nationwide, is the fact that there are these huge tracts of foreclosed homes in a lot of cities across the country that are becoming sort of the dwelling place for vagrants and homeless and drug dealers and other miscreants of that sort, and that, of course, accelerates the decline in property values. When you have homes of that sort that cluster in a neighborhood, it drives down the value of every home in that neighborhood. And as a result, you end up with a breeding ground for social pathologies, and that tends to proliferate, tends to reproduce itself, and the effects of that tend to engender a type of receptivity on the part of municipal government for police state type action. It's sort of gentrification in reverse, and that attracts the police state element. And there's a HUD program that I became aware of a couple of weeks ago that amounts to sort of an urban homesteading program for police officers, where police officers can buy these homes that are foreclosed homes in an urban environment for a farthing, just a farthing practically. The local municipal government can buy these homes for a dollar, or sometimes a trivial price that's not much more than a dollar, and then resell them to police officers for a very low price on very favorable terms to the police officers. So the idea is that, you know, we're almost seeing sort of like the Homestead Act of the 19th century, where they're treating these urban areas as almost a wilderness, almost a frontier-type environment, which I think is interesting and disturbing. The other thing that we're finding, and this is something I started writing about way back in early 2006, is a phenomenon of metal poaching, where the market value of a lot of the metals that you find in construction sites and homes and buildings, the market value has gone up so radically that organized theft rings are now starting to plunder a lot of these foreclosed homes, stripping from them the copper wiring and the copper plumbing, and then other appointments of that sort, and melting them down, selling them, selling them to scrap metal dealers. When you've got copper here, that a few years ago was, I think, about 75 cents a pound, and now it's, last I saw, about $3.92 a pound for copper. A lot of that's, of course, is being snapped up by Beijing, which has become the factory floor for the world. They're buying up all the copper and most of the cement and most of the scrap iron, the pig iron and things of that sort. And a lot of it's going to India as well. India is now a thriving industrial concern. We've been deindustrialized as a matter of conscious policy, and now India and China are buying up all this scrap metal. There's a story that I blogged about a couple of days ago describing how in places like Ohio, copper and other metals used in plumbing, heating systems, and telephone lines are more valuable than some homes. Think of that for a second. The prices of these homes have fallen so radically that it's perceived by the local municipalities anyway that the copper and copper wiring and the copper tubing, copper piping of these homes is actually more valuable than the homes themselves. I quote a fellow by the name of Mark Charney from Brockton, Massachusetts, who's a real estate broker in that town. And he describes how thieves attack one of his most promising properties here. He says they cut the copper wiring here and pulled it right out of the wall.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stanley. William is simply pointing out that in many of the homes, why, first, the copper piping, the copper wirings, things of that sort, are more valuable than the home itself, and that actually thieves now are targeting homes and going in and cutting out the copper piping, cutting out as much of the copper wiring as they can, and pick the story up there, William.
Yeah, what happens is that when a house is vandalized that way, it becomes impossible to sell. And that becomes a problem, of course, for the lending institutions that have foreclosed on these homes. I mean, if you're, for instance, a real estate broker and you're trying to sell a home that has been vandalized in this way, you're not going to be able to sell that home. And so you end up with a suggestion that I saw just this week in the Wall Street Journal. I'm trying to remember the name of the analyst who made this suggestion, but he's talking about these huge tracts of homes that are now standing vacant that don't have any any realistic possibility of being sold anytime soon. He didn't specifically mention the ones that have been cannibalized by the metal thieves, but he might well have been thinking of these homes. It's becoming a very common thing to see this. He said, what we need to do is we need to spend just a little money, the federal government has spent a little bit of money, and go and bulldoze these homes. Just take the bulldozers to them and plow them underground. And the first thing I thought of when I read that suggestion was what happened during the depth of the insanity of the first part of the New Deal back in the 1930s, when you had FDR and the Blue Eagle stormtroopers out trying to inflate prices artificially. They said, well, a depression is a general decrease in prices, so we have to make sure that the prices stay up. And so they went out and forced people to sell their product or their services at an artificially high price, and they actually put a tailor in jail because he dared to sell a shirt for a couple of pennies less than a competitor below the federally established floor. But with respect to what was going on in the agricultural realm, they had farmers plowing under a lot of their crops so as to create artificial scarcity to keep the prices up. And that's a program that continues to this day in various ways through the Agriculture Department. Now we got the Wall Street Journal, the supposed voice of capitalism, actually the voice of corporatism, talking about applying the same illogic to the housing market. There are too many houses? Well, obviously we need to go out and start destroying a few. That'll raise the price of housing, and that'll work wonders for the market.
In other words, it'll produce a shortage of homes, and then exactly. The prices will go up. And of course, this was, I remember so well what they did during the Great Depression. Basically what they did is they poured dye on these potatoes, turned them all blue, and then they plowed them under to actually create a shortage of potatoes so the price would go up. The problem was we had people in America who were facing starvation. On one hand, of course, they're sympathizing with these people. On the other hand, they're destroying the food that the people needed. And this is the insanity of any program that the government undertakes. And my old saying, and I believe it to be true, is that there's no problem facing America today that a new government program won't make worse.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the logic of that's the logic of government, such as it is. And it seems to me that what's going to happen is that we're probably going to see that being the suggestion of plowing under homes, demolishing homes if they're not being sold, that's probably going to be in some way incorporated to in the policies that are going to emanate from Washington now to deal with this unfolding housing crisis, as opposed to letting the price of housing fall to its natural level. That's of course a perfectly intelligent way to approach it. The market will find a way of matching buyers and sellers. That's the irresistible logic of free exchange. And it's so foreign to our way of thinking now in this country that we would actually look upon a general decrease in prices as a good thing for consumers. We've been taught to think that it's a bad thing because we need to go out and spend to make sure that the economy is kept up through our relentless consumerist habits. Well, that doesn't work that way. And what we should be doing right now with the housing market, with the lending market, with the problem of debt, is we should simply back off and let the bad debts shake themselves out, let people take their losses, let the non-viable entities go under, and let the people who have made bad loans undergo foreclosure and bankruptcy where necessary in order to get started over again. People do make mistakes. That's something which has been going on since time immemorial. Government cannot hold back the logical course of the market. The problem here is that we've been taught that there's some numinous mystical power the government can exercise that can make water run uphill and that can keep the business cycle going indefinitely on the basis of credit and inflated currency. And it just doesn't work that way. And it's interesting, you mentioned starvation, the specter of starvation. That's something I'd like to talk about with respect to what's going on right now in a really eerie echo of what happened in the Great Depression, what's going on with our food supply.
All right, fine, we're going to be back here in just a moment. But, you know, there was a man named Adam Smith, and he talked about the invisible hand of the economy. And, of course, he really was the free market economist at the time of the American Revolution. And, of course, writing it in 1776, he talked about how the economy, if just left alone, free enterprise, it would all work out. There was an invisible hand that was behind it. And there really is. Get the government out of it, let people work it out on their own. That is the ideal solution. Stan. This is Dr. Stan. Our guest, William Grigg. William, go right ahead.
We've been talking a little bit about this new phenomenon of metals poaching, which is something that I started to notice a couple of years ago when the price of copper shot up from 70 cents a pound to a couple of dollars a pound. It's now almost $4 a pound. We talked about people tearing copper wiring out of homes that have been left vacant through foreclosure, ripping out the copper plumbing. One of the other things that we've seen is people ransacking air conditioners. People, in one instance I'm aware of, went out and stole all the copper wiring out of a high school football stadium, so to where they had to move the Friday night football game to a different venue because they couldn't activate the lights. Somebody got out and stripped all the copper out of the stadium lights. And another story that I mentioned here in the blog that I wrote a few days ago about this subject involves a fellow by the name of Gary Barton. He's a walnut farmer from California, and his irrigation pumps have been ransacked several times by copper thieves. And one thing that's likely to happen to this fellow is something that's happened to grain farmers and farmers across the country, is that he might find himself targeted by crop rustlers. It's interesting how these terms are being modified to suit our current environment. You wouldn't normally think of somebody poaching metal, and you wouldn't think of somebody normally rustling a crop, but that's something that's becoming very common. There's a story published a few days ago, in the National Post from Canada that talks about how grain is the new copper. Now, that's sort of an odd thing to say, but what they mean by that is that grain, like copper, has become a commodity that is so pricey on account of the declining dollar and a couple of other factors that it becomes an irresistible target for thieves and organized crime. The Post pointed out, this is from March 28th, the prices here might have changed a little bit, but not that drastically. The bushel of spring wheat, which has historically traded between $3 and $7, has spiked as high as $24 in recent weeks. Upon that is a reflection of some bad harvest. When I bought several hundred pounds of wheat a couple of weeks ago in anticipation of what's going on now with the marketplace, and just because it's a good idea to be at least somewhat self-sufficient, I talked with the wholesaler here. It took me over a week to get the amount of wheat I was looking for because they simply couldn't get it. And the wholesaler pointed out that, well, globally we've seen some really bad harvests for several years. There's been some anomalous weather. No, it's not the result of global warming. It's just part of the natural cycle of things. But there have been some bad harvests, and there's also a great deal of demand worldwide. The two have combined with the falling dollar to send the price of wheat through the stratosphere. The National Post report continues by talking about how in January of this year, Kansas police began investigating nearly a dozen reports.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is William Grigg. And before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get your blog site, how they can, of course, to get your writings. Incidentally, we did get the two cases of books. Thank you very much. Liberty and Eclipse. It is available from Radio Liberty. It's an excellent book. It deals with the move towards a police state. And ladies and gentlemen, you have to imagine, you have to realize this is not imaginary. It's really very real. The book is inexpensive. Well worth the price, probably a great deal more, but it's an excellent book, Liberty and Eclipse, by William Grigg. But how can people get your material?
Well, I really appreciate that, Dr. Stan. The easiest way to get what I write is to go to the website of the Welch Foundation, for which I work as an editor-at-large, and the website is called The Right Source. And the URL, the web address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. And you'd mentioned that you are carrying the book Liberty and Eclipse. You can also order that directly from the website at The Right Source. And I have to point out once again, the reason I named it Liberty and Eclipse is because I am hoping that what we're seeing right now represents a passing phase. An eclipse is something that is not permanent. It's somewhat terrifying if you don't know what's going on, but it's something that will pass. And it reflects, of course, the natural laws of celestial dynamics. I mean, once we find our Earth in a certain position relative to the Sun and the Moon, an eclipse takes place, at least some places on the planet. And that eclipse is short-lived, and then it passes. I'm hoping that what's going on right now, which is America's descent into unalloyed police state tyranny, is a passing phase. And this is not an autonomous process. This is not something that's simply happening as a matter of celestial mechanics. This is something which is being inflicted upon us by evil designing people who know full well what they're doing. And they are empowered by the indifference, the torpor of most Americans. They are empowered by the fact that so many people were, first of all, frightened into allowing the executive branch to aggrandize itself beyond its constitutional limitations. And secondly, because there's a plurality of people in this country who, for reasons of ideology or simple partisan pettiness, aren't willing to admit what's going on. What we need to do is take a look at what's going on from the position of constitutional principle and confront the truth without fear or favor. And the truth is that as we stand right now, the President of the United States, whoever he is or he or she may be in the next coming couple of years, has the power to rule as a dictator. He has this presidency that has been created under George Bush now has the power to use the National Guard as a Praetorian Guard. It has the power to rule by decree, to consign people to a legal limbo by designating individuals as unlawful enemy combatants and stripping from them every due process guarantee found in the Bill of Rights or even in the common law going back to Magna Carta in 1215. The president claims the right and has exercised the right to order summary execution of civilians, to order and to place his imprimatur on torture of varieties that were practiced under the communist Khmer Rouge, such as water torture, more commonly known as waterboarding. These things aren't going to stop if we see the Republican Party no longer in the White House next year. The office of the presidency has been institutionally modified now into that of a short-term elected dictatorship, and we see at the same time the militarization of law enforcement in this country, the fact that every nominally local law enforcement agency receives money from the Pentagon, from the Department of Homeland Security, turns these local police agencies into affiliates of this Homeland Security state. And the purpose of the book, quite frankly, is to inform its office to anger, to shock, to alarm, and hopefully to motivate people to do something about taking back our country, taking back our Constitution.
Well, I think it's going to do a good job at that. Well, now, before we went to the break, why, you were talking to Cindy about the food shortages, and
yeah,
you'd been out trying to purchase a good deal of wheat, and of course, what actually happened?
Well, what's happened is that you have a situation, among other things. I mentioned, of course, that there have been some bad yields, there have been bad harvests, there's a lot of demand. Another thing that we're seeing, of course, is that in a lot of countries, the price of wheat, because we've been exporting inflation to these countries, the price of wheat is putting it outside the reach of the common consumer. But as well, you have something that I was talking about earlier here, which is this new phenomenon of grain rustling. I mentioned that in Kansas earlier this year, the police started investigating all these reports of thieves simply driving up to grain silos and bins and siphoning out tens of thousands of dollars worth of wheat and then selling it to anybody who'd be willing to pay for them. The same thing's going on in Canada. It's happening not only with wheat, but it's also happening with corn. You see where in California almonds have been stolen in bulk. You see this happening with a number of different staple foods that are indispensable, quite frankly, to the American diet. You take a look at the price of rice. Rice has hit an all-time record. Just today there was news to the effect that corn is heading for an all-time record as well. Barley futures are trading at twice of what they did in 2006. Soybean futures are tripled during the same period. The prices for oats and I mentioned rice, they've also headed skyward. And all this reflects not only increased demand, but just as importantly, the decrepitude of the dollar. And if you take a look overseas and just sort of scan the horizon for what's going on right now, just a couple of weeks ago, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, which is an organization for which I don't have a whole lot of respect, but they do pay attention to certain trends that I think are significant. They talked about how we're facing a perfect storm for world hunger here. Unfortunately, their reaction to this, the solutions that they pose to these problems would make matters infinitely worse, but they're correct in talking about the fact that there's a problem. There have been food riots in Egypt and in Mexico and Guinea, Mauritania, Morocco, Uzbekistan, Senegal, Yemen, and elsewhere. And Pakistan, this is a really good example of a government intervening to do exactly the wrong thing. You have armed soldiers deployed by that dictatorship, in stores throughout the country to guard wheat and flour deliveries in order to prevent storekeepers from violating mandatory government-imposed quotas, limits on what people can buy. And then in the Philippines, President Arroyo has started using police to crack down on what they call food hoarders. Now, this is all going on overseas in all these countries that are part of this dollar empire. I mentioned imperialism by the dollar here. You know, these people are compelled, because their central governments are compelled to keep dollars in their foreign exchange holdings. All these countries are part of this dollar system. And they're feeling the first bite of food inflation, that is to say, price inflation with respect to food, with respect to those irreplaceable things that are kept out of our consumer price index. And once that starts to hit here, and it's starting to take a bite here, things are going to get really nasty in a hurry. One of the reasons we're seeing this market being created, this sort of quasi-black market in stolen grain and stolen agricultural products here, is because we're at the early stage of what's going to be a really nasty series of steep spikes in the price of staple foods. And already, if you take a look at the price of everything that is made with wheat, whether you're talking about bread or flour, whether you're talking about prepackaged baked goods, whether you're talking about the pizzas that you order from your delivery man, these prices are all going up. And a lot of fast food restaurants now are sort of hard-pressed to keep prices down for the same reason, interestingly enough, why it's difficult to buy a hamburger in Zimbabwe for less than, I believe it's 25 or 30 million Zimbabwean dollars. I mean, in Zimbabwe, you have to pay literally 25 or 30 million dollars in order to eat a Big Mac. And as I've said before, you know, if you go to McDonald's in Zimbabwe, the sign doesn't say millions served. It says it costs millions to be served here. And you have the anomalous spectacle in Zimbabwe of starving millionaires and billionaires who can barely get by. We're not quite there yet, obviously, but that's the trend line, you know, in terms of what's happening. And when it gets to the point that we find ourselves literally wondering if you're a farmer, if your crop's going to make it to market because somebody's interested in stealing it and selling it on the black market, you know that things have gotten really crazy here, and it's not going to get any better.
Yeah, I'm afraid that you're right. I think that most people are totally unaware of the very real possibility that we could have food shortages right here in the United States. Today, in fact, you were talking about the thieves stealing wheat here in the United States, and certainly we know in India and in Indonesia, where they grow a great deal of rice, they actually have guards in the fields to keep people from coming in and stealing the rice because the price is getting so high and people are hungry. The average American says it could not happen here, and I would always ask, why couldn't it happen here? If God is just, do you honestly think that he is going to let us live in the affluent society as we export our inflation to other countries? And when that inflation comes home to the United States, why, of course, you're going to begin seeing the same things here that started during the early phases of the inflation in Zimbabwe. Hope and pray it never gets as bad as it is there today.
You know, the other thing is that we're a net importer of food now. I was astonished last year. I did a piece for the American Conservative talking about a lot of the concerns relevant to the import of...
Go right ahead. We're just having a little problem here. Go ahead.
Okay. I mean, a lot of people were alarmed over the fact that a lot of the dog food, the pet food that people were buying last year from China had melamine in it, which is... a polymer that's toxic that creates kidney and liver problems that are fatal for dogs and cats. And in investigating the fact that we were importing food from China, I was amazed to find out that we were importing wheat from Canada. And I sat back dumbfounded and say, why on earth would the United States have to import wheat from anybody? Because it used to be, I mean, until the late 1960s, early 1970s, that the United States was literally the breadbasket of the entire world. We produced enough wheat to feed the entire world. Now we're importing wheat from Canada. Canada, of course, produces wheat, and it also produces oats and triticale and a number of other grains. They're very productive. That was one of the things that they had a big push in the early 1900s in Canada to make it a big exporter of grain. But they really should not be in a position of exporting wheat to the United States. And it just struck me as really bizarre that we find ourselves now where we don't really have autonomy, if you will, as a producer of our own food. At the same time, we've been exporting this inflation, and of course that means that when the dollar starts to decline relative to other currencies, and we start importing food from these other countries that have stronger currencies than ours, that's another factor that's going to put upward pressure on the prices that we're going to pay for food here in the United States. Add to that the fact, and this is a wild card, that a number of truckers' organizations, the long-haul overland truckers, are understandably upset about the prices that they're paying for diesel. You know, the price of diesel is just absolutely extortionate right now. And a lot of these people who are independent contractors have found that their livelihood has become very imperiled. I mean, I've read a couple of cases, and I know of a couple of cases of people who are acquaintances of mine here in Idaho who've seen their income reduced almost by half or even more over the last year or so, as they've had to pay the fuel expense of their trucks that they own and operate. I just talked with a friend of mine from New Jersey who's a long-haul trucker, and he's getting out of that line of work. But there's been talk now about having a trucker's strike. And if you want to think of a nightmare scenario, imagine what would happen if we had a trucker strike that lasted just for a couple of weeks, and you couldn't find your store stocked, your local retail store stocked with everything that you've come to consider readily available at a whim. You know, we have 24-hour retail stores in this country. You know, your local big box mart is probably open 24 hours. And if, for instance, before you go to bed at night, you realize that you're out of breakfast cereal or bread for breakfast in the morning, you think nothing about getting into a car and driving to the big box mart and filling up with very inexpensive or relatively inexpensive bread and cereal and things of that sort. Well, a trucker strike, I think it would only take about a week or a week and a half before we started to feel the bite of a trucker strike. And what would be driving this trucker strike? Well, it would be people, agitators most likely, paid for by the same gang of usual suspects, who'd be capitalizing on the outrage the truckers feel over the inflated price of the fuel that they're having to buy. And the reason why that price is inflated is because of the dollar's descent. So it all goes back to the fact that our currency is being systematically debauched. The Federal Reserve, the official counterfeiting arm of the regime that rules us, is debauching the currency. And the people that are profiting from this, once again, you've got to go back to this. You take a look at the people on Wall Street, the politically protected investor class, people who are not free market capitalists. They're what Adam Smith called men of system, people who profit by their connections to the political rulers as opposed to producing goods and services that the market would reward. They're the people who are being rewarded right now. And a lot of them are in a position right now, think of what happens with Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns, their CEO, the guy who led that investment bank, the fifth largest investment bank in the country, to a point where their stock, which had traded at $150 a year ago, traded for $10 a share when they were bought up by J.P. Morgan Chase, he had the temerity to say, well, the problem was that there were people spreading rumors about the financial health of our organization, and they drove the price of the stock down. No, that's not what happened. What happened is that they leveraged their $80 billion assets, what I think was 167 times, if I remember correctly. You know, in the derivatives market, they had positions worth between $13.5 and $15 trillion. You know, they'd basically written checks, if you will, for between $13.5 and $15 trillion on the basis of a bank account that had $80 billion in it. That's a very crude analogy, but I think that's a serviceable way of explaining what they did. That's what got them into trouble. And if they had been allowed to go down, if Bear Stearns had been allowed to go down and bear the brunt of their own mismanagement, the fear was that they would take down the entire investment banking system with them. The Lehman Brothers would have been next, and one by one they would have been dragged down into the vortex. And so what happened is the Federal Reserve did what it always does. It stole the value of our money by essentially issuing billions, tens of billions of dollars of promises that have to be redeemed in the form of inflated currency, each increment of which steals the money of what we have earned stealthily while we sleep. It just absolutely beggars comprehension that we put up with this.
Yes, it really is too bad. Actually, it was about a $30 billion loan that they gave to Bear Stearns. And here's a company that had $80 billion of assets, and yet they have to loan them $30 billion, supposedly using assets as you know, so that they hope to get the money back again. But, you know, I fear that, of course, the eventually we're going to see more and more and more crisis situations such as this. And, of course, eventually, of course, why we may very well see many of our major investment banks going down. Well, we're just about out of time here. My guest this evening has been William Grigg. Of course, you can go to his website there at RightSourceOnline.com, RightSourceOnline.com. William is a regular guest here on Radio Liberty. We always enjoy what he has to say. His book, Liberty in Eclipse, is a must. We'll tell you a little bit later how to get it. William, thank you so very much for being with us. We look forward to having you back again next week as we begin trying to explain to our listeners that America's in real trouble because we've turned against the sound finance and we've turned against God. Thanks so much for being with us.
God bless.
And hold on for just a minute, Brian. We've got a few minutes more to go before we let you off the line. Well, William, got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Dr. Stan, I do think one of the advantages of our predicament here, and this is something that we've talked about before, is the possibility that if the system runs out of money, that a lot of the people who are paid to carry out these policies that destroy our rights and imperil our property may simply walk away from their posts and not carry out the duties that have been assigned to them. I mean, they're bound to their masters by purely mercenary connections. So if the money's not there, chances are they're not going to be interested in doing what they've been contracted to do. I do think, however, that there's a possible downside to that. If you take a look at what happened in Europe in the 17th century during the period of the 30 Years' War, you had these mercenary armies called the Confederi. And a lot of them, once they were freed from their connections to the royal governments that had paid their salaries, they simply went out as freebooters. They went out and pillaged the countryside, living off of the wealth and the property and the farms and the crops of the Christian peasants of Europe, because the royals could no longer afford to pay them. That's another possibility. You take a look at the depredations of Blackwater and KBR and outfits of that sort. There's certainly the potential for that type of thing to happen in our situation as well. The point is that there's something that each of us can do right now to improve his situation, the situation of his family, and that is to make yourself as self-sufficient as possible. Limit your exposure in the banking system right now. Don't expect that you will always be able to rely on your bank to be solvent. The FDIC has gone out and hired, I believe it's 200 specialists in dealing with bank collapses in the anticipation we're going to be seeing some bank collapses this year. As a matter of fact, Ben Bernanke has said we're going to see some bank failures. Make sure that you're as liquid as possible. Get out of debt. Try to do something about making yourself self-sufficient in food. It would be a good idea, of course, to have some holdings in real money, that is to say, hard metal assets, things that are circulatable in the event that we do have a crisis, whether it's long-term or short-lived. And bear in mind that in all things you do, keep in mind that you should seek to know God's will and do it. That's our only ultimate source of security.
Amen to that, of course, because behind everything that's going on, there really is a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And what people really do not understand is there are powerful spiritual forces aligned against those of us who, of course, espouse the Christian religion and personal freedom. Good night, William. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Good night, and God bless.
You too. Bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our conversations with William Grigg. We always enjoy them. Well, first of all, if you're interested in knowing more about long-term storage food, and if you're going to lay in supplies, don't put it off. And whether you get it through Radio Liberty or somebody else, begin making plans to look after your family. If you'd like to get a free catalog from us or send any advice on this issue, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. They simply ask for the emergency food catalog, but if you get it, do not put it off. And then, of course, to understand what's happening financially, my talk on the financial tsunami, the syllabus that goes with that, and the two little pamphlets we've written One is called The Financial Meltdown. The other is The History of Money. And then, of course, the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. You need to understand what is happening and why we're facing a destructive inflationary spiral in America, and, of course, the ultimate destruction of our financial system, because there really are people within the ruling elite who want to destroy this nation so that they can merge us into a world government. Now, if you'd like to understand who these people are, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to hear our talk, and it's available on DVD, The Forbidden Secret. And then, of course, we've got some four tape sets, classics in their own way. One is called The Secret Government, and you'll hear the interview with Professor Kara Quigley, who is Bill Clinton's mentor, as he talks about how his book was actively suppressed. Now, here's a professor who taught at Harvard and Princeton and Georgetown University, who is Bill Clinton's mentor, and he talks about the suppression of his book. He talks about the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, saying, oh, these foolish right-wingers, they tell me that emblem is the emblem, of course, of the Illuminati. Why, it isn't. It's been around 5,000 years. And he's absolutely right. Professor Quigley was a brilliant historian. He knew the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, that glorified eye within the triangle above the top of the pyramid is the emblem of the ancient mystery religions. And, of course, what we're seeing today is the fulfillment of the prophecies, the plans of the ancient secret societies and mystery religions being played out in America today as we move towards a new world order, a new world religion, and, of course, the enthronement of a new world leader. If you want to know more about the new world leader, you need to get the DVD of Constance Cumby, who talks about the emergence. What's the emergence? The emergence of the world leader. And there really are people who want that. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America is under attack today. Our way of life, our values, are being aggressively eroded by the people who hate Christianity and who hate Christians and who hate individual freedom. There really are people out there with a different world vision, and you need to help us to get the information out. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com, where you can read our newsletters for nothing, watch many of our DVDs for nothing, listen to our radio programs live 3 hours a day, listen to our archive programs, listen to our MP3 programs, or listen to our live feed, 4 hours a day, actually 9 hours a day, but you can listen to 4 hours a day of our programs through our live feed, to our satellite, and then we hope that many of you out there, if you're capable of it, will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us, because, well, we're dependent upon you to maintain the outreach that we have with almost 60 different outlets of one type or another every single week. But your job is to get other people to listen to our programs, to tell them, to encourage them, to let them understand that if they care about freedom, but even more than that, if they care about their financial situation, that they're going to lose their pensions, their insurance policies, the value within them, they're going to lose the value of their certainly of their CDs, of their bank deposits, their treasury bonds, everything that they've worked for all of their life will be destroyed when this country's monetary system is destroyed. Maybe then they'll start to listen. Your job is to tell them. God will make them listen if he wants.